This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. With months of La Nina rain forecast, New South Wales and Queensland residents who were devastated by floods earlier this year are scared time to move to higher ground is running out. The New South Wales government's released its response to an independent flood inquiry, promising a buyback scheme for severely flood-prone homes in the Northern Rivers region. But as John Daly reports, there's little detail about who can apply or when they'll be moved to safety.
6 months on, Harper Dalton's home in South Lismore is still uninhabitable. He's moved back anyway because he has nowhere else to go. And now he's facing significant risk. The floods will be back this summer.
I'm fearful mainly because of the inadequate response and that I'm just going to be left in a tent like so many other people are still living in Lismore. Fortunately, I've been able to move back into my home because it's classed as uninhabitable, but it still has walls and it's better than a tent.
The report from the New South Wales Flood Inquiry says people in the highest risk areas of the Northern Rivers floodplains needed to be relocated urgently. And while it recommends land swaps and buybacks, the Perrottet government hasn't been able to give any details about how that'll work.
Well, I don't know if I'm eligible for a buyback. I don't know if my neighbour's eligible. I don't know what that's going to look like, what the time frame is. So all of those types of details. But I think the first place to start is where and when.
The New South Wales government says expressions of interest for the buyback scheme will open by the end of this month. But with the Bureau of Meteorology predicting a 70% chance of a third summer soaked by La Nina, Tweedshire Mayor Chris Cherry says time is running out.
It's crushing down on people, just that idea that they could go through another event. I think if the government can give people some certainty as soon as possible that they've got a way out where they'll be safe the next time this happens, that's the best thing they can do.
Across the border in southeast Queensland, the joint Commonwealth State Government funded Resilient Homes Fund is further ahead. About 470 have registered interest in the buyback scheme. The Queensland Reconstruction Authority says so far about 30 homeowners have been approved to take part in the Goodna area near Ipswich, which was identified as a priority. Goodna resident Tony Caswell is still waiting to hear back about his home.
No, the lady just said, look, it'll be a few months. And I said, that's very understandable because they'll be hammered, you know.
The prospect of another wet summer worries him, so he's packing up again.
Oh, just probably very uncertain, John, what to do. Starting now, because we're bringing stuff back, but now I'm preparing to take it back out again.
And Tony Caswell can't help but be sceptical of government promises.
So you make promises, yeah, it's like we're going to build a bridge somewhere and 5 years later we're still going to build a bridge. I'm not going to criticise, but I'm just sceptical of where the money's coming from. Are they going to screw us?
Flood-affected Goodna resident Tony Caswell, John Daly reporting there. It's not just Lismore residents who are frustrated by the lack of details about the flood buyback scheme. Kevin Hogan, who's the Federal Nationals member for PAGE, which covers much of the Northern Rivers region, has blasted the New South Wales government for being too slow.
We have people who are literally, and I'm not exaggerating this, who are literally camping in their own houses. They have no internal walls. They may have hot water if they're lucky. They may have bought a gas stove to cook something on. A lot of them are in caravans. A lot of them are still couch surfing. And they need to make decisions about their homes. Are they going to invest back in their homes? What are the options that they have? And all we've done after 6 months is simply say, we need to look at those three issues. It's not quick enough.
Well, another of the key recommendations from the New South Wales Flood Inquiry is the need for better public warnings about looming disasters, a more accurate rainfall and flood forecasting. Annie Guest reports.
When Lismore flooded in February, local Angus Curnow saw chaos and desperation.
I decided to assist in any way I could, put my number out on the internet and my name, and received a flood of messages calling for help. Jet ski operators come to me and then I would tell them where someone at need across the river, which was extremely hard to get across on in a flat bottom tinny, similar to what the SES had.
The inquiry has found that the SES had limited capacity to respond and that multiple Northern Rivers communities felt abandoned. Recognising the so-called Tinny Army performed hundreds of rescues, it's recommending training residents in flood-prone areas on how to conduct rescues using private boats.
I could see myself, I could see many of my friends and many of the people of Lismore wanting to be a part of that.
31-year-old Angus Curnow says it sounds like less of a volunteering commitment than the SES.
A small amount of training, and then they would only have to, you know, be called on once every few years, potentially.
But what about getting people out of harm's way before a crisis hits? Many residents were unaware of the scale of the impending disaster as rain fell and creeks rose.
I discovered that there were terrible problems with the system of creek and rain gauges.
Annie Keir lives upstream from Lismore. The inquiry found the Bureau of Meteorology's rain gauge network is not fit for purpose and that the river gauge network needs to be significantly enhanced and appropriately maintained.
Parts of it were very badly maintained. Rain gauges were not working or dysfunctional. Creek gauges got submerged in the flood and were poorly positioned.
The inquiry is recommending that all levels of government collaborate on better catchment-wide modelling and warnings drawing on real-time rainfall and flood data. That's welcomed by Lismore councillor Ellie Bird, who coordinates a recovery group called Resilient Lismore.
We need to become flood literate. We need to become more literate in reading, understanding that information for ourselves. And definitely one of the aspects as the event is unfolding is that the gauges along the creeks and the rivers should work.
That's Lismore Councillor Ellie Bird ending Annie Guest's report. Anyone with air conditioning will know the temperature setting is often a source of debate. In Spain, the government's settled that argument. Despite a heatwave, public places are being ordered to raise the thermostat to 27 degrees. It's part of Europe's drive to reduce dependence on Russian gas ahead of what could be a very bleak winter. Europe correspondent Nick Dole reports from Madrid.
In Orteza, a high-end tailor's shop in central Madrid, the air is feeling very thick. It's not even lunchtime yet, but the temperature is hovering around 30 degrees outside, and shops like this one have been ordered to keep their air conditioning at 27 degrees to save energy. For the stylist, Christina Mokong, the heat makes it hard to concentrate on the task at hand.
Oh my God, terrible, yeah. It doesn't change.
And so do you think there's a few people who might be tempted to cheat a little bit and turn the temperature down a bit?
Of course.
Christina says she's now selling more breathable suits and shirts to help customers cope with modern conditions like heat waves. The country's Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has even publicly ditched his tie and told government officials they should start dressing down too so they can withstand the temperature that he's set for the nation. Spain's doing this as part of a Europe-wide effort to reduce dependence on Russian gas, which has got much less reliable and much more expensive since its invasion of Ukraine.
Before the invasion, Europe depended on 40% of gas supplies from Russia. So now we're in a situation where we have to unwind it quite quickly, and the problem is who will supply that gas.
Dr. Maria Shagina is a research fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. She says Europe's failure to diversify its energy supplies has robbed it of a bargaining chip that could have put much more pressure on Vladimir Putin.
The energy sanctions are this hard-hitting tool in Europe's toolbox. And at the moment, any discussion on gas embargo is just not on the table because it's too painful. As I said, there are not many suppliers out there. So building this domestic resilience is important that can have actually impact on the war.
The EU wants member states to cut gas usage by 15% to build some reserves ahead of the winter. In Germany, where household gas prices have tripled in a year, authorities have asked people to take shorter showers, even cold ones in some regions. Greece, Italy and France have also cracked down on air conditioning use, and some European cities are no longer lighting monuments at night. Spain isn't dependent on Russian piped gas, but the government says it can still reduce consumption and export supplies to its neighbours. Most Spaniards AM spoke to supported the new air conditioning law, but the tourists we met on a baking hot day in Madrid weren't so understanding.
Yeah, I don't think that is good enough. 27 degrees.
It's crazy. I'm sorry, but it's very crazy. I think nobody follow the rule.
Will you be following the rule?
No.
She won't have to. Tourists are exempt. Everyone else can expect to sweat it out over summer. This is Nick Dole in Madrid reporting for AM.
In another sign of Donald Trump's lingering influence over the Republican Party, one of his fiercest critics has failed in her bid to run for re-election. Liz Cheney has suffered a landslide loss in the primary contest for her congressional seat to a hand-picked Trump candidate. But she's vowing to continue her part in the investigation into the January the 6th attack on the US Capitol and Mr. Trump's attempts to cling to power, and is even toying with the idea of running for president herself. Here's North America correspondent Carrington Clark.
The size of Liz Cheney's loss was even worse than dire polls were predicting, the Donald Trump-endorsed challenger Harriet Hageman thrashing her by more than 35 percentage points. But rather than be bowed by the loss, Liz Cheney today told NBC she'd potentially look to run for president herself and take the battle up to Donald Trump directly.
That's a decision that I'm going to make in the coming months, Savannah. I'm not going to make any announcements here this morning, but it is something that I'm thinking about.
Liz Cheney comes with an impeccable Republican pedigree. The daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney, she's a conservative foreign policy hawk and pro-business. But her massive loss in Wyoming, heartland territory for the Republicans, demonstrates the stranglehold Donald Trump still has on the party. That's according to Gregory Warrow, a professor of politics at Columbia University.
The easy path is basically to say the things that the Trump supporters want to hear.
He says the chance of Liz Cheney grasping the Republican nomination for president is slim, but she could still damage Donald Trump's campaign if he chooses to run by campaigning as an independent candidate.
If she mounted a third-party challenge, doesn't win the Republican nomination, but throws her hat into the ring as a third-party challenger, I think she would attract a lot of Republican votes, especially among women who are turned off by Donald Trump. And that strategy could work in terms of keeping him from getting back into the White House, because it could work to split the Republican vote.
Liz Cheney already has a sizable war chest at her disposal. She's taken the millions of dollars remaining in her campaign fund and placed them in a new political action committee, commonly referred to as a PAC. She changed the name from Liz Cheney for Wyoming to The Great Task. Her team says it will be used to stop Donald Trump becoming president. Gregory Warrow says Donald Trump might be the unassailable leader of the Republican Party at the moment, but his air of invincibility could fall if the candidates he's supported through the primary contests falter and fail to win at the midterm elections.
If these are the candidates that are going to get through and they end up losing the general election race, is Donald Trump really the person they want to be leading their party?
Donald Trump has soundly defeated Liz Cheney in her home state, but she might be able to get revenge in 2024 on the national stage. This is Carrington Clark in Washington, reporting for AM.
Monkeypox vaccines are being distributed quickly around the world to stop the spread of the disease, but the World Health Organization's warning the drug's not 100% effective, saying people at risk must take other precautions. So far, more than 35,000 cases have been reported in 92 countries, including 70 cases in Australia. Stephanie Smale reports.
Cases of the painful virus are rising, with thousands of people, mostly from Europe and the Americas, suffering symptoms including fevers, rashes, headaches and lesions. The World Health Organization's Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says monkeypox is spreading fast.
Almost 7,500 cases were reported last week, a 20% increase over the previous week.
Vaccines are already being rolled out to protect people in Australia, with tens of thousands more doses on order and expected to arrive next month. But the World Health Organization's Dr. Rosamund Lewis is warning vaccination doesn't offer complete protection.
We have known from the beginning that this vaccine would not be a silver bullet, that it would not meet all the expectations that are being put on it, and that we don't have firm efficacy data or effectiveness data in this context.
She explains so-called breakthrough cases where people are still getting sick despite having the vaccine are a reminder that people at risk, particularly men who have sex with men, need to take other precautions to protect themselves.
Every person who feels that they are at risk and appreciates their own level of risk and wishes to lower their own level of risk have many interventions at their disposal, which includes vaccination where available, but also includes protection from activities where they may be at risk, reducing number of sex partners, avoiding group sex or casual sex, and specifically when a vaccine is in fact administered, waiting until that vaccine has the time to produce a maximum immune response.
That's 2 weeks for the vaccine that's currently available. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says public health efforts need to be stepped up too.
The primary focus for all countries must be to ensure they're ready for monkeypox and to stop transmission using effective public health tools, including enhanced disease surveillance, careful contact tracing, tailored risk communication and community engagement, and risk reduction measures.
As the vaccine rollout slowly begins in Australia, there's concern not everyone who is eligible is getting access, particularly in regional and remote areas. Sean Mulcahy from La Trobe University's Australian Centre in Sex Health and Society says people living outside cities will need protection too.
If you look at the data, for example, here in the city of Ballarat, we have a higher percentage of LGBTIQA plus people than they do in the metropolitan city of Melbourne. So as we get more vaccines, we need to have a look at the way that we are locating the clinics and ensuring that all people who are at risk have access to the vaccines.
That's Sean Mulcahy from La Trobe University, ending Stephanie Smale's report. The federal election marked a new phase of First Nations voices in politics, with a record 11 MPs and senators in the parliament. That electoral success has given momentum to a push for more Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women in politics at all levels of government, from local councils to state and federal parliaments. Political reporter Claudia Long has more.
Let's take over the parliament. Yay! Yay!
Sometimes potential political candidates aren't always who you'd expect.
I'm not enrolled to vote. So it's actually given me a different perspective on should I enrol or shouldn't I?
But Carissa O'Meara from Derby in the Kimberley region of Western Australia feels ready to run for politics.
I do want to enrol because I actually want to help my town. I want to get into the Shire. I want to be on the council. I want to do more for the people in my town and the community.
While her eyes are on local politics, we're standing out the front of Parliament House on Ngambri-Ngunnawal country, also known as Canberra. She's here to meet politicians and more than 50 other First Nations women as part of the Straight Talk Summit.
I came in knowing nothing, and I'm just in this day or two, I've walked out with a lot of knowledge about Parliament, so I'm very excited to walk in and see what's to go today.
Backed by Oxfam, the summit's designed to encourage First Nations women to get involved in politics and give them the tools to create changes in their communities as well. There have been big strides for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in federal politics, with a record number of First Nations parliamentarians, and big changes on the horizon, with the country set to vote in a referendum on an Indigenous voice to Parliament during this term of government. But politics can still be an unwelcoming place, especially for First Nations women. West Australian Greens Senator Dorinda Cox says programs like Straight Talk are helping to change that.
It's so heartwarming to see so many First Nations women here in the Parliament and to be able to make this place a little bit more friendly in relation to that.
And she says politicians also benefit.
I think Straight Talk provides an important opportunity for us as politicians to understand what some of the barriers and the challenges are for First Nations women participating in politics and how, from a grassroots democracy perspective, we can engage better.
For the program's leader, Michelle Deschong, it's a chance to equip First Nations women with the skills and the opportunity to get to grips with politics.
A lot of the time, people are trying to enact change, but sometimes they don't know where the right place is to start or who the right people are in terms of the decision makers that they need to be talking to.
She says participants take their new knowledge and networks in all sorts of directions.
Along the way, you know, people take lots of different ideas and put them into practice when they get home. So we have had people run for political office, local government. They've sought different careers.
And seeing them in the halls of power, she says, is an incredible feeling.
Seeing women walk through these halls for the first time is really something quite phenomenal.
The Straight Talk Summit runs until tomorrow.
Claudia Long, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Scott Morrison says he was sworn into multiple ministries for the good of the Australian people. But does that fit the facts? Today, Insider's host David Spears, what we're learning now about the motives of the man who was our leader for almost 4 years. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.